the beautiful campus of Texas A&M University, the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology brings you the Sports Medicine Podcast. Our mission is to make sense of and connect the science, practice, and application of the latest findings in sports medicine and human performance to the real world. Here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
We want to welcome everyone here today for the Huffines Sports Medicine Institute podcast. We have a special edition today in honor of stock car racing season is about to start. A couple of things before we get started. We want to remind everyone that we've got a big event coming up on April 1st called the Huffines Discussion. We're bringing in eight national leaders and thinkers in sports medicine. We're giving them each 18 minutes. And we're going to find out what they're going to say. So we'd invite you to join us April 1st. And if you can't make it to College Station at that time, we'll be putting those up on our web podcast a little bit later on for video as well. Also, remember that listen for the podcast here today. There'll be a question. And if you're the first one to answer the question and send us an email on that, you'll get a free T-shirt. And Justin will have that question for us a little bit later. As I said earlier, we're really excited today with the podcast. We have got a very special guest with us, Mr. Mike Fisher, who is the Managing Director for the NASCAR Research and Development Center in Concord, North Carolina, is here with us. Mike, it's so great to have you on today.
Thank you very much, Tim. Good to be here.
Thanks. Yep, everything's about to get started for you guys, isn't it?
Yep, we're coming into our first event of Speed Weeks for 2011. This Saturday night, we've got the Bud Shootout, and Sunday is Daytona 500 qualifying, and that leads us into the following week where we'll have the Gatorade Duels and then the truck nationwide and cup race over the weekend next weekend. So
now
big busy time of the year for us.
Yeah, and I would bet most of our listeners, we're going to talk about some sports medicine stuff, but I would bet they didn't even know that NASCAR had a research and development center. Can you tell everyone a little bit about what you do and what the center does there?
Sure. The center was basically started in 2002-2003 time frame. We focus on three elements of the sport that generally don't get a lot of attention or a tremendous amount of attention from the racing participants. The first and foremost is safety in motorsports. The second is competition. We're the technical arm of our competition group.
So you're the one that check and make sure the carburetor plates are all the right size and so forth?
That type of thing. We come up with all of the inspection methodologies that our competition folks utilize at the racetrack every weekend, and we help work with them to design those and perform any analysis that's necessary as far as looking at the cars after the event to ensure that they meet the rules. Mm. The last element that we work on, which has been fairly relevant given our current economy and the economy for the past few years, is we focus a little bit on cost management to make sure that we're not writing rules and regulations that are driving unnecessary costs to the teams. And we continually monitor their budgets to make sure that the cost of participating in our sport is well matched with the sponsorship opportunities that are available in each one of our series.
Yeah, now to give folks, I guess, an idea of what it costs to run a car in the Elite Series, which is the Sprint Cup Series, what kind of budget do these guys run?
The top teams in the Sprint Cup Series are operating probably on a budget between $25 and $30 million per season.
So that's just one car?
That's one car.
Wow, that's quite a budget. So a lot of cost there. For sure. But we're here to talk about sports medicine, even though costs are part of sports medicine in so many different areas. You know, stock car racing in many parts of the country is really not thought of as an athletic sport, that its participants, whether the drivers or the pit crews, really aren't athletes. How would you respond to that kind of thought?
Well, to be honest, I'd say, first, they're wrong.
Okay.
stock car drivers certainly are athletes. If you think about what they do, it may not be physically taxing in the traditional ways that people think of that. There's not obviously a lot of running involved. There's not a lot of...
We hope there's not running involved.
Yeah, exactly. Muscular, cardiovascular, or cardio activity. But I guarantee you they do need a very high level of endurance to compete. Mm. They sit inside of the cockpit of a race car that on most days in the summer while they're racing, temperature probably exceeds 115 degrees, 120 degrees. They do this for approximately 3.5 to 4 hours of racing. And on many of the ovals that we race around, they experience 2 to 3 Gs going through the corners. So they've got to support themselves and brace themselves. So definitely need to be in shape to do that. Need to have a very strong core to your body as far as your core strength to withstand the forces that are involved in racing.
So that's quite a combination, 115 to 120 degrees. They're in double-layer fire suits with a helmet on and gloves and boots, and they're undergoing G-forces for 3 or 4 hours. That is a pretty good load.
Yep. Yeah. You definitely need to be an athlete to be a race car driver for sure.
Wow. Well, how about pit crew guys? Don't they just kind of like fall over the wall and throw tires on?
Pit crew guys are obviously subject to a little bit of the same ambient condition that the drivers are. They're obviously not in the car and subject to the heat there, but what their task is they come over the wall as a team and have to go through an extremely choreographed routine of changing the tires and fueling the vehicle and making any necessary adjustments. And they do all that. A team of 6 guys this year will be doing all that in the course of about 13 to 14 seconds.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be nice if we could pull into a gas station and get filled up and all 4 tires changed in 12 seconds?
It'd be much more convenient for a number of folks, for sure.
Yeah. We tend to watch, many people not only watch this in person, I think it's the second most popular spectator sport in the country, or is it number one?
It's number two. We're behind the NFL.
Number two.
But we're definitely number two.
And if anybody that's listening has been to one of these races, you know there are a huge number of people that are there, and it's really sometimes easy to get disengaged from actually the danger that's involved. I mean, when you have 43 cars that are racing literally side by side at 185, 190 miles an hour, there's huge potential for risk to the human participants in that.
No, certainly. One of the primary focuses that we have here at the R&D Center is safety, and that's really safety for everybody. The drivers themselves, the race crews, our officials that are involved in the event and working on pit road, as well as the fans.
Right.
So it's one of our primary focuses and something that we've worked very hard on over the past 9-10 years to steadily improve.
Yeah. Now this last 10-year period of time has been one, really, I think, where NASCAR really has stepped up. And I'm not sure a lot of people know what has gone on behind the scenes. The catalyst for this, of course, was Dale Earnhardt's death about 10 years ago. Actually, 10 years ago this month, wasn't it?
That's correct.
And can you outline some of the things that have happened? I know you've been at the forefront of this for the last 5 or 6 years. And there have been some really important safety changes that have occurred for both the drivers and the spectators in that period of time.
Yeah, really it started, as you mentioned, with the death of Dale Earnhardt Sr. There were several fatalities the previous year in NASCAR as well. In our international series, and it really refined and emphasized the efforts that kind of started a little bit already, but really weren't full on. We weren't running full speed with improving our safety. And the death of Dale Earnhardt Sr. really kicked that into gear, and again got the activity started here at the R&D Center. And what we found, and I don't imagine it's a whole lot different from a methodology standpoint than any other sport, is you really have to break down what is causing your injuries. Mm-hmm. And we did that and looked at the things that had caused these fatalities that we had, and consulted with some outside biomechanics experts and medical experts. And really what they told us was a little bit of the opposite of what we thought we had to work on, which was surprising to a lot of folks in our industry. But most of the experts within NASCAR thought that we would have to fix the race car to make that safer. That was the most important thing we needed to do, to redesign it and structurally improve it. And what the experts actually told us was that what we needed to focus on first, and with most of our effort, was driver restraint and work on the restraint systems in the vehicles, the seat belts, mandate head and neck restraint, the seating in the cars, all of those types of things to properly restrain the driver.
Right.
So that's really where we started. After that, we moved into the safer barriers that are at most of our National Series racetracks, as far as cushioning what the drivers were crashing into. And they identified that kind of as the second priority that we needed to have.
And that was a big process.
That was a huge process, because we worked with the University of Nebraska in developing that system. And once... the first place it was installed, I believe, was Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And once it proved its mettle there, and through the testing that they did at Nebraska, we started the implementation of the safer barrier at all of our national series racetracks.
Yeah, and that wasn't just a process of putting up foam rubber on the concrete walls and calling it a day, was it?
No, there was a very extensive research process that went into the materials that were used for that, not only the materials for the barrier itself, but then the cushioning materials behind it. All had to perform in a certain way and a certain density, and we had to take into account the fact that our cars weren't the only cars that were racing on a lot of those tracks. Mm-hmm. There were also Indianapolis Indy style race cars, open wheel cars, and they have a significantly different signature both on the racetrack and from a mass standpoint as well. So it had to accommodate the designs of multiple different cars. So that was a pretty big project.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously the last element of it was redesigning the race car. We had that first, and the experts told us, no, you need to worry about that last. And we completed that, and the first race for the new chassis that had been strengthened and redesigned was in 2007. Mm-hmm. In the Sprint Cup Series, and that same chassis will be raced full-time this year in the Nationwide Series, our second series down underneath mm-hmm. the Cup Series. So those drivers will also have the benefit of that improved chassis.
And the results of all this effort on this has been, there have been very few injuries at any of your upper-level series since that time.
That's correct. We've been very fortunate in that a lot of what we've done has proven to be very successful. We have not had a career-ending injury, I believe, since 2003.
Yeah.
And we're hoping to keep that streak going. And really, that's what allowed us to get down to the level of detail and the level of work that we need to keep moving that safety element of the sport forward. It's sometimes very challenging to work on a solution when you've got the specter of a racing fatality hanging over your head.
Right.
And the pressure that's involved with that to come up with an answer and a solution.
Right.
So it's a much, working this way and trying to be in a proactive preventative mode is a much better working environment for myself and the engineers that are focused on it.
Right. And I think for the folks that are listening, to give them a bit of perspective on the violence of these crashes when they occur. Because like I said, on TV, there's even sometimes in person, you're removed from it, so it doesn't appear to be that bad. For example, Earnhardt's crash didn't look to be that bad as compared to some others that you'd seen. And I know you guys were monitoring impact forces with some accelerometers mounted in the car. What kind of impacts are they seeing? Are the drivers seeing when they do crash?
Well, obviously, it depends. As you mentioned, every crash is different.
Right.
Some of the crashes that look very, very bad on television are very spectacular, with cars tumbling and careening down the track. Those crashes tend to be the ones that don't cause as much injury, simply because a lot of that energy from the impact is being dissipated and attenuated as the car goes through all the gymnastics that it does down the racetrack. The ones that generally concern us back here at the R&D Center are the ones that kind of have a dull thud, that there's not a lot of reactive force coming off the wall or the object that they hit. And what basically the reason for our concern is that most of that energy is translated into the car and into the occupant. And that's where we our anxiety level goes up a little bit.
Yeah.
But we've seen, as well as IndyCar, we've seen crashes approaching. IndyCars have seen crashes at 100 G's, and we've seen them upwards of 70 to 80 G's.
Wow.
So there's a tremendous amount of force involved when one of these cars comes to a violent and sudden stop.
Yeah, and the human body wasn't meant to take those kind of forces, so you definitely have to protect it.
Yep, and that's part of what we learned as well with a lot of our restraint, is that the first step in giving the occupant a good chance of making it through one of those is they have to be properly restrained.
Right.
If you restrain them very well and very securely, they have a much better chance of surviving that incident without injury.
Right. And I know the racing industry now has had the head and neck restraints mandated for the last, 8 or 9 years, and it's almost inconceivable. There was a time that the driver said, we don't want to wear that because it may limit us.
Maybe one of the biggest things that happened in motorsports over the past 10 years, and it's one of the things that I'm most proud of, and I've only been involved with it for about half that time, is that the culture and the education of the participants, not only drivers but crews and teams and everybody in our industry, the culture and knowledge and concern about safety has gone up dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have that kind of focus, that's really what it takes to advance the sport, because we only have a limited amount of people here at the R&D Center. And to really get that safety moved forward and continue moving it forward, we need the help of all the participants in our sport, and we have that, and that's been one of our big pushes, is to continue to educate people on the benefits of head and neck restraints and explain how they work and what they do, that type of thing. So that's been a big focus for us.
Yeah. It's interesting that you talk about educating the folks, especially the teams, about the importance of safety. You and I have chatted in the past about educating the grassroots, because their motorsports at the grassroots level in the United States is huge. It's a huge sport. You know, there are these little dirt bull rings all over the country where people take their cars every week and race them. And what can NASCAR do to help those people incorporate safety into what they do on a weekly basis?
I think the obligation of any sanctioning body that works with those types of racers, whether it be NASCAR or others, as well as the racetrack owners and promoters, the first thing you need to do is to educate your participants and make sure they understand that the benefits of the safety equipment that's available to them, the fact that in most cases that is a very cost-effective strategy to protect yourself. I think a lot of the people look at the safety things that we've implemented in the Cup Series and our other national racing series, and they say, that's not for me. Those guys are going a lot faster than I am. Their cars are more powerful. I really don't need that level of protection. And one of the biggest things educationally that we try to reinforce to our racers that are racing at that level is that if you're going more than 40 miles an hour on a racetrack, you can certainly benefit from a head and neck restraint, and,
right.
and you will need it if you crash at 40 or 50 miles an hour. So it's difficult to get people to grasp that, but again, that's our educational challenge, and that's part of what we need to do.
Yeah, they forget that their head is a 13-pound pumpkin sitting on their neck, and that if nothing's holding it back, it's going to, you know, if your body's being held back, your head's going to go someplace that it's not supposed to go.
Yep, the educating them in the physics of the simple physics, I should say, of what happens in a crash is sometimes a challenge. But they don't call them laws of physics for nothing.
No,
you're not going to get around them.
But so many times they say, well, you know, I could buy a head and neck restraint, or I could buy a new set of tires for my race car. The new set of tires will make me go faster. And so there's always that argument, isn't it?
That's one of the challenges that we face, but. If they have seen some of the things that we've seen here at the R&D Center, for me at least, that'd be a very easy decision to make.
Yeah, yeah. The as my wife said when we were racing, she said, "How much is your head worth?" Yeah, okay, we'll get one of those. Not a problem. So, what do you see coming in the future, Mike? What are the areas that you guys are continuing to work on?
The things that we're working on now is one of the things that is going in place this year is a new black box recorder that we talked about a little while ago. We gather information on every crash that happens on the racetrack through a box containing accelerometers, and we're implementing a new system this year that's just like a laptop computer. The system we had previously worked very well, but we've been using it for the last 8 years or so, and better, smaller, faster technology, more memory, all these types of things are available. So we took advantage of some of those in the unit we've redesigned and are using this year.
Yeah.
Kind of the next step for us, the things like safer barriers and head and neck restraints, those types of things are really generational type improvements to safety. Those are big jumps. And we're not satisfied, obviously, waiting for those types of aha moments to come along. So we continue to work in all areas of safety. We go back, we revisit restraints, and really try to find the areas that maybe we can better define for the race teams and do some additional testing. But one of the things that we're kind of focusing on based on some recent crash events over the past couple seasons is intrusion on the driver. we redesigned the vehicle, as I mentioned, and put that on the racetrack and the chassis in 2007. But we've had several incidents since then that have maybe made us want to go back and take a look at the structure of the vehicle and see if there's any additional optimization that could happen. It's no doubt that the new chassis is an improvement from our previous generation, but now that we feel pretty comfortable in the way we have drivers restrained, we're starting to go back and look at intrusion. And as you mentioned, drivers can withstand, if they're properly restrained, they can withstand a pretty high degree of G's, and it varies by individual. But as human beings, we're all pretty equally susceptible to intrusion. In layman's terms, we don't squish very well.
No, we don't. At least I don't.
I don't either. so that's something we're looking at in the race cars to see if there's anything we can do structure-wise going forward. We're doing that by creating computer models of the chassis and of the race cars, and we'll be evaluating different geometries, different structures and materials, those types of things in those computer models to see if we can come up with a combination that improves the crush resistance of the car.
Interesting. Hey, well, let me ask you one last question here. We're about to run out of time, and I know you guys are getting busy and ready for speed weeks. What about hydration? We've talked so much here on the podcast about proper hydration, and you told us a while ago the drivers are exposed to like 120 degree heat for 3 and 4 hours at a time. It's hard to drink. So what kind of mechanisms does NASCAR allow and that the teams have put in place to make sure that the drivers stay hydrated?
Most of the drivers utilize, especially during the hot summer months, utilize a hydration system in their vehicle. We do allow that. They have basically all different sorts of bladders and things like that inside the car that they utilize to hydrate themselves. We don't limit what's put in those. So you can put an electrolyte type drink in them. You can put water, whatever you want. And a lot of it though is also involved in just the physical conditioning. Just like any athlete that whether you're a football player going through two-a-days in August. Or a race car driver, you've got a helmet and pads on, so your head's covered, which is one of the primary paths to release heat out of your body. And so a lot of the challenges and the things with hydration are very similar for race car drivers as they are for other athletes that wear heavy, bulky equipment in hot weather.
Yeah.
A lot of the drivers also take advantage. A lot of times when you watch it on TV, you will see hoses coming out of their helmets, on the tops of their helmets. And what that hose is doing is pumping cool, filtered air down through their helmet. And again, that's an attempt to keep their head cool and evaporate any sweat that's coming out. So they have a number of strategies and techniques that are available to them to try to manage that heat.
Yeah, it is. It's an interesting sport, and there's been some interesting solutions worked up to some of those problems for sure. So we always give our guest an opportunity at the end to give people a take-home message. And we're going to change that just a bit for you. If people tune in over the next couple of weeks and they watch the kickoff of the season, what should they be looking for? What would be your take-home message that they should keep an eye out for?
Well, I think with the newly repaved Daytona surface, we're going to have some extremely exciting racing that drivers are going to be able to attempt passing moves and other types of maneuvers on the racetrack that they haven't been able to do at Daytona for probably 20 or 30 years. So I think from a racing standpoint, it's going to be extremely exciting. And I would imagine, as with most Daytona races, we will see a couple of accidents, and hopefully all of those will result in the drivers being able to walk away from them. And if they do, maybe the folks who have listened to this will have a little bit better insight as to why they're able to do that.
Well, and we hope there aren't any accidents, because that means your Tuesday morning is really busy, isn't it?
That's true.
You guys do the accident breakdowns. So.
Yep, and I'm hoping we have an uneventful Tuesday a couple of weeks from now.
Yeah, there you go. Well, Mike, thank you again so much for taking the time to be with us. We may chat with you later in the year and see how things are progressing along.
All righty. Thank you very much, Tim.
And thank you all for listening, downloading, and listening out there. We really appreciate the fact that you have taken the time to be with us. We'd ask that you pass us on to your friends and family. That's the way that people find out about us. And we didn't forget, we do have a question for you, and so we'll turn it over to Justin here.
So what are the three main elements that Mr. Fisher's research center focuses on?
So be the first one to email us at huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. Be the first one to email us to that email address and with the answer to the question, and you'll win one of our snazzy Huffines podcast t-shirt. Be the first one on your block to have it. And again, thank you all for being here, and we hope that you have a healthy and active week.
The Sports Medicine Podcast is produced by Justin Dobson and licensed by the Huffines Institute at Texas A&M under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sidney and J.L. Huffines family. Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zeltner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzeltner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by John Miles Productions at johnmilesproductions.com. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.